reality won't be able to keep up. So we stay in front of the truth about how tired and scared and confused and overwhelmed we sometimes feel. Of course, the irony is that the thing that's wearing us down is trying to stay out in front of feeling worn down. This is the self-perpetuating quality of anxiety. It feeds on itself. I often say that when they start having 12-step meetings for busyaholics, they'll need to rent out football stadiums. In addition to fear, another barrier that gets in the way of both stillness and calm is how we're raised to think about these practices. From very early in our lives, we get confusing messages about the value of calm and stillness. Parents and teachers scream, "Calm down and sit still," rather than actually modeling the behaviors they want to see. So instead of becoming practices that we want to cultivate, calm gives way to perpetuating anxiety, and the idea of stillness makes us feel jumpy. In our increasingly complicated and anxious world, we need more time to do less and be less. When we first start cultivating calm and stillness in our lives, it can be difficult, especially when we realize how stress and anxiety define so much of our daily lives. But as our practices become stronger, anxiety loses its hold, and we gain clarity about what we're doing, where we're going, and what holds true meaning for us. Dig deep. Get deliberate. My anxiety detox included more calm and more stillness, but it also included more exercise and less caffeine. I know so many people who take something at night to help them sleep and drink caffeine all day to stay awake. Calm and stillness are potent medicine for general sleeplessness and a lack of energy. Increasing my daily intake of calm and stillness, along with walking and swimming and cutting caffeine, has done wonders for my life. Get inspired. I remain inspired and transformed by something I learned from Harriet Lerner's book, The Dance of Connection. Dr. Lerner explains that we all have patterned ways of managing anxiety. Some of us respond to anxiety by overfunctioning, and others by underfunctioning. Overfunctioners tend to move quickly to advise, rescue, take over, micromanage, and get in other people's business rather than look inward. Underfunctioners tend to get less competent under stress. They invite others to take over and often become the focus of family gossip, worry, or concern. They can get labeled as the irresponsible one, or the problem child, or the fragile one. Dr. Lerner explains that seeing these behaviors as patterned responses to anxiety rather than truths about who we are can help us understand that we can change. Overfunctioners like me can become more willing to embrace our vulnerabilities in the face of anxiety, and underfunctioners can work to amplify their strengths and competencies. Get going. Experiment with different forms of still and quiet. We all need to find something that works for us. To be honest, I'm never more open and emotionally clutter-free than when I'm walking alone outside. It's not technically still, but it's an emotional opening for me. How do you dig deep? Guidepost number 9. Cultivating meaningful work. Letting go of self-doubt and supposed to. In the chapter on creativity, I wrote that a significant part of my work involves making connections. In fact, the heart of my work is finding and naming the subtle and often unspoken connections between how we think, feel, and act. Sometimes the connections are easy to spot and fall right into place. Other times they are elusive, and trying to put things together feels messy and tangled. This guidepost started out as one of those messy and tangled experiences, but with time, I learned about some striking connections. Early in this research, it was clear to me that living a wholehearted life included engaging in what many people I interviewed called meaningful work. Others spoke of having a calling, and some simply described feeling a tremendous sense of accomplishment and purpose from their work. It all seemed pretty straightforward, except for this pesky list of words that emerged as being important and somehow connected to the quest for meaningful work. Gifts and talents. Spirituality. Making a living. Commitment. supposed to's. Self-doubt. I say pesky because it took me a long time to figure out how they all work together. The exhausted part of me wanted to forget about these extra words. Much like what Steve does when he puts together furniture from IKEA and there are 12 unused screws when he's done. I wanted to stand back, give it a little shake, and say, good enough. These must be extras. But I couldn't. So I took apart the idea of meaningful work, interviewed more participants, found the connections, and rebuilt the guidepost. This is what emerged. We all have gifts and talents. When we cultivate those gifts and share them with the world, we create a sense of meaning and purpose in our lives. Squandering our gifts brings distress to our lives. As it turns out, it's not merely benign or too bad if we don't use the gifts that we've been given. We pay for it with our emotional and physical well-being. When we don't use our talents to cultivate meaningful work, we struggle. We feel disconnected and weighed down by feelings of emptiness, frustration, resentment, shame, disappointment, fear, and even grief. Most of us who are searching for spiritual connection spend too much time looking up at the sky and wondering why God lives so far away. God lives within us, not above us. Sharing our gifts and talents with the world is the most powerful source of connection with God. Using our gifts and talents to create meaningful work takes a tremendous amount of commitment because in many cases the meaningful work is not what pays the bills. Some folks have managed to align everything. They use their gifts and talents to do work that feeds their souls and their families. However, most people piece it together. No one can define what's meaningful for us. Culture doesn't get to dictate if it's working outside the home, raising children, lawyering, teaching, or painting. Like our gifts and talents, meaning is unique to each one of us. Self-doubt and supposed to. The gauntlet of gremlins can get in the way of cultivating meaningful work. They start by taunting us about our gifts and talents. Maybe everyone has special gifts, except for you. Maybe that's why you haven't found them yet. Yes, you do that well, but that's not really a gift. It's not big enough or important enough to be a real talent. Self-doubt undermines the process of finding our gifts and sharing them with the world. Moreover, if developing and sharing our gifts is how we honor spirit and connect with God, self-doubt is letting our fear undermine our faith. The gremlins get lots of mileage out of supposed to, the battle cry of fitting in, perfectionism, people-pleasing, and proving ourselves. You're supposed to care about making money, not meaning. You're supposed to grow up and be a blank. Everyone's counting on it. You're supposed to hate your work. That's the definition of work. If you're brave, you're supposed to quit your job and follow your bliss. Don't worry about money. You're supposed to choose work you love or work that supports the people you love. To overcome self-doubt, and supposed to, we have to start owning the messages. What makes us afraid? What's on our supposed-to list? Who says? Why? Gremlins are like toddlers. If you ignore them, they get louder. It's usually best to just acknowledge the messages. Write them down. I know it seems counterintuitive, but writing them down and owning the gremlins' messages doesn't give the messages more power. It gives us more power. It gives us the opportunity to say, I get it. I see that I'm afraid of this. But I'm going to do it anyway. Nice to meet you. What do you do? In addition to the gremlins, another thing that gets in the way of meaningful work is the struggle to define who we are and what we do in an honest way. In a world that values the primacy of work, the most common question that we ask and get asked is, what do you do? I used to wince every time someone asked me this question. I felt like my choices were to reduce myself to an easily digestible soundbite or to confuse the hell out of people. Now my answer to what do you do is, how much time do you have? Most of us have complicated answers to this question. For example, I'm a mom, partner, researcher, writer, storyteller, sister, friend, daughter, and teacher. All of these things make up who I am, so I never know how to answer that question. And to be honest with you, I'm tired of choosing to make it easier on the person who asked. In 2009, I met Marcy Albaher, an author slash speaker slash coach. If you're wondering what's up with the slashes, I think they're very appropriate, as Marcy is the author of One Person slash Multiple Careers, a new model for work slash life success. Albaher interviewed hundreds of people pursuing multiple careers simultaneously and discovered how slash careers, researcher slash storyteller, artist slash real estate agent, integrate and fully express the multiple passions, talent, and interests that a single career cannot accommodate. Marcy's book is full of stories about people who have created meaningful work by refusing to be defined by a single career. Examples include a longshoreman slash documentary filmmaker, a management consultant slash cartoonist, a lawyer slash chef, a rabbi slash stand-up comic, a surgeon slash playwright, an investment manager slash rapper, and a therapist slash violin maker. I wanted to share the idea of the slash effect with you because in the blogging, art, and writing world, I meet so many people who are afraid to claim their work. For example, I recently met a woman at a social media conference who was an accountant slash jeweler. I was excited to meet her because I had bought a beautiful pair of earrings from her online. When I asked her how long she'd been a jeweler, she blushed and said, "I wish. I'm a CPA. I'm not a real jeweler." I thought to myself, "I'm wearing your earrings right now, not your abacus." When I pointed to my ears and said, "Of course you're a jewelry maker," she just smiled and replied, "I don't make very much money doing that. I just do it because I love it." As ludicrous as that sounded to me, I get it. I hate calling myself a writer because it doesn't feel legitimate to me. I'm not a writer enough. Overcoming self-doubt is all about believing we're enough and letting go of what the world says we're supposed to be and supposed to call ourselves. Every semester I share this quote by theologian Howard Thurman with my graduate students. It's always been one of my favorites, but now that I've studied the importance of meaningful work, it's taken on new significance. "Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive." Dig deep. Get deliberate. It can take some time to figure out how to get deliberate about doing meaningful work. I finally got very specific and wrote down my own criteria for meaningful. Right now, just for me, I want my work to be inspiring, contemplative, and creative. I'm using these as a filter to make decisions about what I do, what I commit to, how I spend my time. Get inspired. I highly recommend Marcy Albaher's One Person slash Multiple Careers. It includes lots of practical strategies for living the slash. Malcolm Gladwell is also a constant source of inspiration for me. In his book, Outliers, Gladwell proposes that there are three criteria for meaningful work: complexity, autonomy, and a relationship between effort and reward, and that these can often be found in creative work. These criteria absolutely fit with what cultivating meaningful work means in the context of wholehearted journey. Last, I think everyone should read Paulo Coelho's The Alchemist. I try to read it at least once a year. It's a powerful way of seeing the connections between our gifts, our spirituality, and our work, slashed or not, and how they come together to create meaning in our lives. Get going. Make a list of the work that inspires you. Don't be practical. Don't think about making a living. Think about doing something you love. There's nothing that says you have to quit your day job to cultivate meaningful work. There's also nothing that says your day job isn't meaningful work. Maybe you've just never thought of it that way. What's your ideal slash? What do you want to be when you grow up? What brings meaning to you? How do you dig deep? Guidepost number 10. Cultivating laughter, song, and dance. Letting go of being cool and always in control. Dance like no one is watching. Sing like no one is listening. Love like you've never been hurt. And live like it's heaven on earth. Mark Twain. Throughout human history, we've relied on laughter, song, and dance to express ourselves, to communicate our stories and emotions, to celebrate and mourn, and to nurture community. While most people would tell you that a life without laughter, music, and dance would be unbearable, it's easy to take these experiences for granted. Laughter, song, and dance are so woven into the fabric of our everyday life that we can forget how much we value the people who can make us laugh, the songs that inspire us to roll down the car window and sing at the top of our lungs, and the total freedom we feel when we dance like no one is watching. In her book, Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy, social critic Barbara Ehrenreich draws on history and anthropology to document the importance of engaging in what she refers to as collective ecstasy. Ehrenreich concludes that we are innately social beings, impelled almost instinctively to share our joy. I absolutely believe she is right. I also love the idea of collective ecstasy, especially now when we seem to be stuck in a state of collective fear and anxiety. As I sifted through my data, I asked myself two questions. One, why are laughter, song, and dance so important to us? Two, is there some transformational element that they have in common? These were complicated questions to answer because, yes, we yearn to laugh and sing and dance when we feel joy, but we also turn to these forms of expression when we feel lonely, sad, excited, in love, heartbroken, afraid, ashamed, confident, certain, doubtful, brave, grief, and ecstasy, just to name a few. I'm convinced that there's a song, a dance, and a path to laughter for every human emotion. After a couple of years of analyzing my data, here's what I learned. Laughter, song, and dance create emotional and spiritual connection. They remind us of the one thing that truly matters when we are searching for comfort, celebration, inspiration, or healing. We are not alone. Ironically, I learned the most about laughter during the 8 years that I was studying shame. Shame resilience requires laughter. In I Thought It Was Just Me, I refer to the kind of laughter that helps us heal as knowing laughter. Laughter is a spiritual form of communing. Without words, we can say to one another, I'm with you. I get it. True laughter is not the use of humor as self-deprecation or deflection. It's not the kind of painful laughter we sometimes hide behind. Knowing laughter embodies the relief and connection we experience when we realize the power of sharing our stories. We're not laughing at each other, but with each other. One of my favorite definitions of laughter comes from writer Anne Lamott, whom I once heard say, "Laughter is a bubbly, effervescent form of holiness." Amen. Song. From the 8-track tapes my parents played in our station wagon, to my stack of vinyl records from the 1970s, to my mixtapes from the 80s and 90s, to the iTunes playlist on my new computer, my life has a soundtrack. And the songs from that soundtrack can stir memories and provoke emotion in me like nothing else. I realize that not everyone shares the same passion for music, but the one thing that is universal about song is its ability to move us emotionally. Sometimes in ways we don't even think about. For example, I was recently watching the director's cut of a movie. It showed a very dramatic scene from the film with music, and then without music. I couldn't believe the difference. The first time I watched the film, I didn't even notice that music was playing. I was just on the edge of my seat, waiting and hoping that things would turn out the way I wanted them to. When I watched it without music, the scene was flat. There wasn't the same level of anticipation. Without music, it felt factual, not emotional. Whether it's a hymn at church, the national anthem, a college fight song, a song on the radio, or the carefully scored soundtrack to a movie, Music reaches out and offers us connection, something we really can't live without. Dancing. I measure the spiritual health of our family by how much dancing is happening in our kitchen. Seriously. Charlie's favorite dance song is Kung Fu Fighting, and Ellen likes Vanilla Ice's Ice Ice Baby. We're music and dance lovers, not snobs. We're not above kicking it old school with the Twist or the Macarena. We don't have a big kitchen, so when the four of us are in there sock-footed and sliding around, it looks more like a mosh pit than a sock hop. It's messy, but it's always fun. It didn't take me long to learn that dance is a tough issue for many people. Laughing hysterically can make us feel a little out of control, and singing out loud can make some of us feel self-conscious. But for many of us, there is no form of self-expression that makes us feel more vulnerable than dancing. It's literally full-body vulnerability. The only other full-body vulnerability that I can think of is being naked, and I don't have to tell you how vulnerable that makes most of us feel. For many people, risking that kind of public vulnerability is too difficult, so they dance at home or only in front of people they care about. For others, the vulnerability is so crushing that they don't dance at all. One woman told me, "Sometimes if I'm watching TV and people are dancing or there's a good song playing, I tap my feet without even noticing it. When I finally catch myself, I feel embarrassed. I have no rhythm." There's no question that some people are more musically inclined or coordinated than others, but I'm starting to believe that dance is in our DNA. Not super hip and cool dancing or line dancing or dancing with the stars dancing, but a strong pull toward rhythm and movement. You can see this desire to move in children. Until we teach our children that they need to be concerned with how they look and with what other people think, they dance. They even dance naked. Not always gracefully or with the beat, but always with joy and pleasure. Writer Mary Jo Putney says, "What one loves in childhood stays in the heart forever." If this is true, and I believe it is, then dance stays in our heart even when our head becomes overly concerned with what people might think. Being cool and always in control. The only true currency in this bankrupt world is what you share with someone else when you're uncool. A quote from the film Almost Famous, 2000. A good belly laugh, singing at the top of your lungs, and dancing like no one is looking are unquestionably good for the soul. But as I mentioned, they are also exercises in vulnerability. There are many shame triggers around the vulnerability of laughing, song, and dance. The list includes the fear of being perceived as awkward, goofy, silly, spastic, uncool, out of control, immature, stupid, and foolish. For most of us, this is a pretty scary list. The gremlins are constantly there to make sure that self-expression takes a backseat to self-protection and self-consciousness. What will people think? Everyone is watching. Calm down. You look ridiculous. Get a hold of yourself. Women spoke about the dangers of being perceived as getting too loud or out of hand. I can't tell you how many women told me about the painful experience of throwing caution to the wind only to be patronizingly told, "Whoa, settle down." Men were quick to point out the dangers of being perceived as out of control. One man told me, "Women say we should let loose and have fun. How attractive will they think we are if we get out on the dance floor and look like assholes in front of other guys, or worse, your girlfriend's friends? It's easier to just hang back and act like you're not interested in dancing, even if you really want to." There are many ways in which men and women hustle for worthiness around these issues, but the two that keep us the most quiet and still are hustling to be perceived as cool and in control. Wanting to be perceived as cool isn't about wanting to be the Fonz. It's about minimizing vulnerability in order to reduce the risk of being ridiculed or made fun of. We hustle for our worthiness by slipping on the emotional and behavioral straitjacket of cool and posturing as the tragically hip and the terminally better than. Being in control isn't always about the desire to manipulate situations, but often it's about the need to manage perception. We want to be able to control what other people think about us, so that we can feel good enough. I grew up in a family where being cool and fitting in were highly valued. As an adult, I have to constantly work at allowing myself to be vulnerable and authentic around some of these issues. I could laugh and sing and dance as an adult, as long as I stayed clear of silly, goofy, and awkward. For years, these were major shame triggers for me. During my 2007 breakdown, strike that, spiritual awakening, I learned how much I've missed while pretending to be cool. I realized that one of the reasons I'm afraid to try new things, like yoga or the hip-hop exercise class at my gym, is my fear of being perceived as goofy and awkward. I've spent a lot of time and energy working on this. It's a slow process. I'm still only super silly and goofy around people I trust, but I think that's okay. I'm also working hard not to pass this down to my kids. It's easy to do when we're not mindful of the gremlins and shame triggers. Here's proof. Last year, I had to run to Nordstrom to pick up some makeup. I was in one of those nothing fits and I feel like Jabba the Hutt moods. So I put on my baggiest sweats, pulled my dirty hair back with a headband, and told Ellen, "We're just running in and running out." On the way to the mall, Ellen reminded me that the shoes her grandmother had bought her were in the back of the car and asked if we could exchange them for a bigger size while we were at the store. After I bought my makeup, we went upstairs to the kids' shoe department. As soon as we cleared the top of the escalator, I saw a trio of gorgeous women standing in the shoe department. They were tossing their long, clean hair over their narrow, square shoulders as they perched on their high-heeled, pointed-toe boots and watched their equally beautiful daughters try on sneakers. As I tried to avoid crumbling and comparing by focusing on the display shoes, I saw a strange blur of jerky movement out of the corner of my eye. It was Ellen. A pop song was playing in the neighboring children's department, and Ellen, my totally confident 8-year-old, was dancing. Or, to be more specific, she was doing the robot. At the very moment that Ellen looked up and saw me watching her, I saw the magnificent moms and their matching daughters staring right at Ellen. The mothers looked embarrassed for her, and the daughters, who were a couple of years older than Ellen, were visibly on the edge of doing or saying something mean-spirited. Ellen froze. Still bent over, with her arms in rigid formation, she looked up at me with eyes that said, "What do I do, Mom?" My default response in this scenario is to shoot a diminishing look at Ellen that says, "Geez, man, don't be so uncool." Basically, my immediate reaction would be to save myself by betraying Ellen. Thank God I didn't. Some combination of being immersed in this work, having a mother instinct that was louder than my fear, and pure grace told me, "Choose Ellen, be on her side." I glanced up at the other mothers and then looked at Ellen. I reached down into my courage as far as I go, smiled and said, "You need to add the scarecrow to your moves." I let my wrist and hand dangle from my extended arm and pretended to bat my forearm around. Ellen smiled. We stood in the middle of the shoe department and practiced our moves until the song was over. I'm not sure how the onlookers responded to our shoe department soul train. I didn't take my eyes off Ellen. Betrayal is an important word with this guidepost. When we value being cool and in control over granting ourselves the freedom to unleash the passionate, goofy, heartfelt, and soulful expressions of who we are, we betray ourselves. When we consistently betray ourselves, we can expect to do the same to the people we love. When we don't give ourselves permission to be free, we rarely tolerate that freedom in others. We put them down, make fun of them, ridicule their behaviors, and sometimes shame them. We can do this intentionally or unconsciously. Either way, the message is, "Geez, man, don't be so uncool." The Hopi Indians have a saying, "To watch us dance is to hear our hearts speak." I know how much courage it takes to let people hear our hearts speak, but life is way too precious to spend it pretending like we're super cool and totally in control when we could be laughing, singing, and dancing. Dig deep. Get deliberate. If we believe that laughter, song, and dance are essential to our soul care, How do we make sure that we hold space for them in our lives? One thing that we've started doing is turning on music in the kitchen while we do a family cleanup after supper. We dance and sing, which in turn always leads to a good laugh. Get inspired. I love making themed playlists, groups of songs that I want to listen to when I'm feeling a certain way. I have everything from a playlist called God on the iPod to a Run Like You Mean It list. My favorite is my Authentic Me list, the songs that make me feel most like myself. Get going. Dare to be goofy. Dance every day for 5 minutes. Make a CD of songs to sing along with in the car. Watch that dumb YouTube video that makes you laugh every time. How do you dig deep? Final thoughts. I think most of us have developed fairly sensitive bullshit meters when it comes to reading self-help books. I think this is a good thing. There are too many books that make promises they can't keep or make change sound so much easier than it is. The truth is that meaningful change is a process. It can be uncomfortable and is often risky, especially when we're talking about embracing our imperfections, cultivating authenticity, and looking the world in the eye and saying, "I am enough." However afraid we are of change, the question that we must ultimately answer is this. What's the greater risk, letting go of what people think, or letting go of how I feel, what I believe, and who I am? Wholehearted living is about engaging in our lives from a place of worthiness. It's about cultivating the courage, compassion, and connection to wake up in the morning and think, no matter what gets done and how much is left undone, I am enough. It's going to bed at night thinking, yes, I am imperfect and vulnerable and sometimes afraid, but that doesn't change the truth that I am also brave and worthy of love and belonging. It makes sense to me that the gifts of imperfection are courage, compassion, and connection, because when I think back to my life before this work, I remember often feeling fearful, judgmental, and alone, the opposite of the gifts. I wondered, what if I can't keep all of these balls in the air? Why isn't everyone else working harder and living up to my expectations? What will people think if I fail or give up? When can I stop proving myself to everyone? For me, the risk of losing myself felt far more dangerous than the risk of letting people see the real me. It's been close to 4 years since that day in 2006, when my own research turned my life upside down. It's been the best 4 years of my life, and I wouldn't change a thing. The breakdown, strike that spiritual awakening, was tough. But I'm hard-headed. I guess the universe needed a way to get my attention. Despite where this book will be shelved in your local bookstore, I'm not at all sure that this work is about self-help. I think of it as an invitation to join a wholehearted revolution, a small, quiet grassroots movement that starts with each of us saying, "My story matters because I matter." A movement where we can take to the streets with our messy, imperfect, wild, stretch-marked, wonderful, heartbreaking, grace-filled, and joyful lives. A movement fueled by the freedom that comes when we stop pretending that everything is okay when it isn't. A call that rises up from our bellies when we find the courage to celebrate those intensely joyful moments, even though we've convinced ourselves that savoring happiness is inviting disaster. Revolution might sound a little dramatic, but in this world, choosing authenticity and worthiness is an absolute act of resistance. Choosing to live and love with our whole hearts is an act of defiance. You're going to confuse, piss off, and terrify lots of people, including yourself. One minute you'll pray that the transformation stops, and the next minute you'll pray that it never ends. You'll also wonder how you can feel so brave and so afraid at the same time. At least, that's how I feel most of the time. Brave, afraid, and very, very alive. About the research process. For thrill seekers and methodology junkies. A couple of years ago, a woman came up to me after a speaking event and said, I hope you won't think this is weird or rude or something, but you don't look like a researcher. She didn't say anything else. She just stood there waiting and looked confused. I smiled and asked, What do you mean? She replied, You seem so normal. I chuckled. Well, looks can be deceiving. I'm so not normal. We ended up having a great conversation. She was a single mother getting her undergraduate degree in psychology and loved her research classes, but her faculty advisor wasn't encouraging her to pursue the research track. We talked about work and motherhood and what researchers are supposed to look like. It seemed that I was missing the mice, the long white lab coat, and the Y chromosome. She told me, I pictured older white guys working in labs and studying mice, not a soccer mom studying feelings. The journey that led me to become a researcher was anything but a straight and narrow path, which, ironically, is probably why and how I ended up studying human behavior and emotion for a living. I was a college drop-in and drop-out for a number of years. During my off semesters, I waited tables and tended bar, hitchhiked through Europe, played a lot of tennis. You get the point. I found the social work profession in my late 20s and knew it was home. I did a 2-year stint in junior colleges to raise my GPA enough to get into a big university with a social work program. It was in those junior college classes that I fell in love with the idea of teaching and writing. After years of dropping out, I graduated with honors from the University of Texas, Austin, with my bachelor's degree in social work when I was 29, and immediately applied for graduate school at the University of Houston. I got accepted, worked hard, and finished my master's, and was accepted into the doctoral program. During my doctoral studies, I discovered qualitative research. Unlike quantitative research, which is about tests and statistics that give you what you need to predict and control phenomena, qualitative research is about finding patterns and themes that help you better understand the phenomenon you're studying. They're equally important approaches, but very different. I use a specific qualitative methodology called grounded theory. I was fortunate enough to be trained by Barney Glasser, one of the two men who developed the methodology in the 1960s. Dr. Glasser commuted from California to serve as the methodologist on my dissertation committee. The basic premise of grounded theory research is to start with as few preconceived ideas and assumptions as possible so that you can build a theory based on the data that emerges from the process. For example, when I first started with what I would later refer to as wholehearted research, I had two questions. What is the anatomy of human connection, and how does it work? After studying the best and worst of humanity, I had learned that nothing is as important as human connection, and I wanted to know more about the ins and outs of how we develop meaningful connections. In the process of collecting data to answer these questions, I ran into shame, this thing that corroded connection. I decided to take a quick detour to understand shame, so that I could better understand connection. At that point, my questions became, what is shame, and how does it affect our lives? My quick detour turned into 8 years. There was lots to learn. I posed new questions based on what I had learned. The men and women who had embraced their vulnerabilities and imperfections and developed a powerful level of resilience to shame seemed to value a certain way of living. What did they value? And how did they cultivate what they needed? These questions became the basis for determining what it takes for most people to live with their whole hearts. My data doesn't come from questionnaires or surveys. I interview people and collect stories using field notes. I'm basically a story catcher. Over the past 10 years, I've collected more than 10,000 stories. I've done formal research interviews with close to 1,000 men and women, individually and in focus groups. People have shared their stories with me through letters, email, my blog, and the courses I've taught. Some have even sent me their art and copies of their journals. I've also presented to tens of thousands of mental health professionals who have shared their case studies with me. When I'm finished interviewing, I analyze the stories for themes and patterns so I can generate theories from the data. When I code data, analyze the stories. I go into deep researcher mode where my only focus is on accurately capturing what I heard in the stories. I don't think about how I would say something, only how they said it. I don't think about what an experience would mean to me, only what it meant to the person who told me about it. Rather than approaching a problem and saying, I need to collect evidence of what I know to be true, the grounded theory approach forces me to let go of my interests and investments so I can focus on the concerns, interests, and ideas of the people I interview. The data coding process is laborious and difficult. My husband, Steve, likes to leave town with the kids when I go into my comparing, coding, memoing phase. He says it's kind of scary because I walk around the house dazed and mumbling with a stack of yellow legal pads in my hands. It's a very attractive process. What I love slash hate the most about grounded theory is that it's never really done. The theory that you generate from your data is only as good as its ability to explain new data. This means every time you collect a new story or a new piece of information, you have to hold it up against the theory you've developed. Does it work? Does it ring true? Does your existing theory work this new data in a meaningful way? If you follow my blog, or if you've attended any of my lectures, you can probably attest to the evolving nature of my theory building. If you want to honor the stories that people have shared with you, you have to stay rigorous in your attempts to accurately capture their meaning. It's a challenge, but I honestly love what I do. If you're really interested in grounded theory, or if you want more information on methodology, visit my website for links to the academic articles on shame resilience theory and the theory on wholehearted living. www.brenebrown.com.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of The Gifts of Imperfection. Let go of who you think you're supposed to be and embrace who you are. Written by Brené Brown. Narrated by Lauren Fortgang. Executive producer, Jennifer Basick. Producer, Mike Charzik. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2010 by Brené Brown. Production copyright 2010 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.